This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten. Did you just say womp womp? And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Flashy lights, Christmas, woo!
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 164 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we have learned to have the utmost respect for the persistence of birds, a healthy fear of slow-moving villains, and a really deep loathing for shovels. Plant your feet, run off some popcorn from the 3D printer, and just keep punching, just keep punching, just keep punching.
Just keep punching.
I am Jay, and with me in the GPR studios, Keir. Keir, how's it going?
I'm awesome. Really, really pleased after this past weekend.
And over there making a slight dent in the wall is Haley. How are you doing, Haley?
Everything
is
awesome.
Use your fist, not your head.
Well, this week we are tearing towards the finale of Series 9 with the penultimate installment, Heaven Sent. It's a near single-handed performance by Peter Capaldi, breathing life and death and life and death into another complex script by Moffat himself. And under the direction of GPR favorite Rachel Talalay. It's a fascinating journey into the mind of a Time Lord under duress, and that's before we get to the cliffhanger conclusion. That, well, personally, we think it's one hell of an episode.
Yeah, you can say that again.
Yeah. Very, very little to the contrary said about this episode. Nitpicks at best.
Yes.
And that's just people that are trying to take a nice complex script and say, well, this clearly doesn't work. Well, if that's what you're scraping at this point, you're just trying too hard. You're not enjoying it anymore. So
yeah.
Loved it.
Oh yeah. Loved it a lot. Absolutely fantastic. I mean, it really, really cannot think of a single thing to complain about with this episode.
I have nitpicks like some folks do, you know, and it really isn't the mechanics, because the mechanics, whenever you're doing something like this, where you're talking about one of these kind of iterative Groundhog Day kind of scenarios with some of the personal twists that Moffat put into this, the rooms reset and that kind of thing, there's going to be loose ends. It's not an airtight script, and that's okay. Because the emotion, the journey taken through this iterative course, and some of the gifts we're given through the episode by far surpass anything that I would say, well, no, that couldn't possibly be, because he put that shovel down against that wall and it should be against that wall, or nonsense like that. So
right. If the room's reset, why is there still dirt on the shovel?
I mean, exactly. But he ran his finger across it. So let's start from there, because obviously, you know, we come into this thing cold and we're learning and getting exposed to some of the facets of this puzzle that, as the Doctor describes it, he's within his own little personal puzzle. It must be like Christmas. and he's figuring out as he goes. As he figures, it's his first time through. Well, it is for us too. Mm. So what about the changing castle? The whole idea of the veil chasing him around slowly, extremely slowly, and somehow still eventually catching up with him as walls move and doors seal and all that good stuff. What do we think about that kind of a setting?
Well, I think it makes sense. The Doctor went from Diagon Alley to wind up in Hogwarts. I mean, that's the way you go.
Mm-hmm. Although, but I like that the whole building is kind of clockwork too, you know?
Mm.
So that, you know, you've got rotating pieces. The whole castle is a rotating piece.
Yeah, each floor turning counter to the floor below mm-hmm. it, and as the catwalks shift, those doors are no longer accessible. It's just that's just a cool little setting in and of itself. You could have done anything with that and had fun with it in any yeah. episode, but if you just get the one doctor and the one villain running around the thing, it makes it that much more intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
The rooms that don't follow any kind of numerical order, obviously, because it's all in a state of change. Although I did wonder, so I'm looking at this veil creature, and you know, we come to realize that it's something sort of wrought from his own nightmares mm-hmm. as a child, you know, the women in the veils and so forth. But it made me think that it reminded me of the kid thing under the blanket and listen. And it just seemed like it was good to know that they could just continue to give that villain employment as he or she or it gets into its later years. Don't worry, you can scare the kids at the orphanage for a little while, but we've got a gig for you.
It's nice to see child actors.
I'm sorry, you just don't look the part anymore.
Your hands are getting a little large.
Yeah.
But that brings us to the first time he has to escape a near-death situation, and you know, with dive through the window, and we get to this internal reasoning, this internal monologue that always takes place within his control room.
Let's just call it the Mind Palace and get it over with.
Okay. Very Sherlock. A lot of people have drawn that parallel. But I really loved the idea of him explaining. Again, he's doing this all internally, but we're being allowed into that. That the faster you think, the slower time progresses as far as your relative observation to it. It makes me think of if you're in a car accident and everyone says it was as if time slowed down
mm-hmm.
because you're observing everything hyper quickly and your brain's processing it. So to you, yeah, that time stretch really does happen. We just don't really have the intellect to get ourselves out of the pending crash.
Right. And that's the great thing too, is that, you know, the doctor kind of explains it all, and you know, he throws the chair out of the window and counts the seconds till it splashes, and you know, works out the wind resistance. Like, you know, he jumps out of the window and he's already figuring out the wind resistance and how far he's got and this, that, and the other. And it's like, it's moments like that that you're like, holy crap, no, wait, that's right. This guy is like, you know, stupid intelligent. It's crazy how smart he is. And you mm-hmm. tend to forget that sometimes because it does have to get dumbed down for us to figure it out. Right. But it's moments like this, you're like, okay, no, that's right. He can totally figure this stuff out.
I really enjoy the fact that on first watch, as you're seeing him kind of, especially when he gets into that one bedroom, that one bed chamber, and you know, he's looking at the aging patina on the painting and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But like, he comes in, he hops in the bed once, because you always do that. You get into a hotel room, you test out the bed, you bounce definitely. On it once or twice. But he's like, you know, he's doing all these little arbitrary things, like putting the loop in his eye when he's talking to this villain, or picking the petals off of the lily and such. And you're like, he's maybe these are just actor's choices. Maybe he's just being really kind of eclectic about this. And then, oh, okay.
No, he's being intelligent. He's being the cleverest one in the room again.
Even though he's alone. Mm-hmm. So did the doctor in an earlier cycle paint that picture of Clara?
No. No. I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I think that this is all something constructed specifically for him. That's why the extra set of clothes were there. You know, that's where the painting was there and this, that, and the other. And it's all constructed specifically for the doctor. So, of course, there would be a painting of Claire there. Of course, there would be, you know, his exact clothes sitting there on the chair waiting for him. So I don't think that it's something he did, because then you get into the whole, well, if the room resets, why is there still the painting there? And why is it aging? And
right. So. Or why was it, if the room resets to have his clothes next to the fireplace, why were they there in the first place?
Which came first?
And you know, and you can toy with that all you want, but I think that detracts from just being able to enjoy the story itself.
And that's one of the great things too, is that we've talked about that, how, you know, if you give us no science at all, we're just going to be like, well, this doesn't make any sense. You know, how is this all happening? And if you give us too much, we're going to start to pick at it. And I feel like this one, it might have given us just a little bit too much science, but at the same time, there was so much going on, so much pretty and so much just amazing storytelling that I was able to look past it and be like, I don't care. I don't care if that doesn't make sense, because this is just absolutely spectacular.
Mm. I think it was probably for the folks that really want to try to understand some of the greater complexities in the script, if it was really something that kind of tripped you up at points, or you were wondering why certain things were functioning the way they were, I believe it was Radio Times later that evening after the broadcast, I think within about 3 or 4 hours, one of their real go-to Whovians wrote up a great article that I'll try and make sure that it gets included into the links, that does a bit of a breakdown of what he was attempting to do, what some of the premise of the of this interrogation chamber, essentially, that he was in, was doing to him. And again, Jay, that goes back to, yeah, this was built to house all of the painful reminders, the fears, all the things that would have the possibility of drawing him closer to divulging his secrets. Let me just ask this. How long did it take you before you realized he was in the confession dial?
I didn't realize until after the episode was over. I mean, at the end.
Okay. Yeah.
I figured it out a little bit before then, but it definitely took me longer than it probably should have.
I was toying around with whether or not he was actually in the dial, or whether he was dealing with the repercussions of the dial being turned over, and someone was grilling him for the information that either could or couldn't be extracted from it. But then, as you were, you know, you're getting some of the clues about like the shifting and the turning and the machinations and the gears and so forth. We've had some listeners that said they picked up on it right away.
Mm-hmm.
And just rolled with it, and they said, okay, that's great, he's in the dial. Okay, then let's see what this leads to, if this is a trial, or if this is a police interrogation, or something of that sort. I don't know. I just saw the fact that when he started getting asked for all of these confessions, and he came to the realization that the confessions were the things that gave him the extra time, mm-hmm. to, or the escape from certain things, that started to fall into place. But I gotta wonder about these dials themselves. Granted, it's a new convention that Moffat has added to canon, mm-hmm. and I don't really have a problem with it. I think it's kind of an interesting premise. But I wonder, do they all work like this? Are the Time Lords so paranoid, so elusive with one another that every time one of them is nearing their death by, well, natural causes or something of that sort, something they can see coming and they can prepare one of these dials, mm-hmm. that they all have to go through this? And it's this arduous.
Have you not watched the show, like, ever? Time Lords are dicks. But, I mean, you got to think, these are professional meddlers. They go and they get into a situation and they alter it to whatever situation they think, you know, however they see best. So, yeah, they're going to have secrets. They're going to have things that, you know, they don't want other people to know that they got involved in and things like that. So, yeah, I can totally see that being a standard thing for the Time Lords.
But then in their true fashion, you can be as secretive and manipulative as you want, but when it comes down to your final breath, now you've got to turn over all of your truths so that we can leverage them exactly. And go be right bastards ourselves.
Exactly.
Okay, lovely. Haley, were you okay with the whole idea of the dial being... Well, I don't want to get to the end yet, but as far as the dial extracting some of the information it was from him, I mean, the fact that it was like, it was going after these core fears and basically trying to find his weaknesses.
Well, I think if it's something that's designed to extract a specific secret, then obviously the secret they were after is information about the hybrid. Mm-hmm. And if you get him to reveal enough of his deepest, darkest truths, then eventually that's the one you're going to get to. And that's what they were after.
Before we get around to what I think is probably my only issue with the episode, there's still some of the mechanics of this castle, this puzzle that he's in, and that's all the room resets and things. We had some folks that really needed to try to understand the whole idea of the transporter actually being a 3D printer, a replicator that's just, you know, putting all the cells together and to match where they were somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I've always enjoyed that, as it's discussed by there's a number of different sci-fi authors that have really played around with the whole idea of, I mean, we're going back to something like The Fly, where it's not you that's going over there, it's just taking matter from the next location, right. And building it to match what you were back, right. On Portal A. But if we're going with a number of iterations through this, billions of them, at least 2 billion iterations of this, and all the rooms reset except for room 12.
Mm-hmm.
We never got an explanation as to why room 12 was the only one that was left intact. I mean, we just accept it. But did I miss a little subtle hint?
No, I don't think you did. But to me, it seemed like it was, and maybe I'm off here, but to me, it seemed like room 12 was at the exact center of everything. Like everything was revolving around 12. So that was why it stayed the same, is because everything else shifted and went back to its original state, but that stayed at the center of the thing and was, you know, left intact.
Okay. You got to wonder, though, with that wall, the Asbantium, Nice. We'll make up a...
The unobtainium.
400 times harder than diamond.
Yes.
That's some serious business. And I love the fact that every time he punches it, he seriously looks like I just did the dumbest thing ever. I had to do it again. Damn, ow, it's just as bad as the last time. Yep, that still stings. That really, really sucked. Over and over and over.
He really did sell it.
Why didn't he bring one of those shovels with him?
Seriously.
They're lying all over the place.
Exactly. And he kept commenting. He's like, what's with all the spades all over the place? It's like someone's trying to tell me something. Yes. It's you saying, take the shovel to room 12.
Trust me on this.
Would have been such a shorter episode.
Yeah, it might have only taken 0.75 billion years instead.
Exactly. But that's, you know.
Well, and you could probably hit it 5 times instead of 3 because you don't got to go, every time.
Okay. Well, all right. Now you've brought that up. The whole actual passage of time. Did time pass outside the dial?
No.
Or was this all something that was being done to him within the dial? It's its own little temporal loop. It's its own little plane of existence. Pocket universe, if you will.
I really took it to be kind of like the prison that Picard gets stuck in Star Trek Next Generation, where it's like it all happens in the span of just a few seconds or whatever. But to him, it feels like it's been 2 billion. Well, I guess technically to him, it feels like it was just one time. But you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yep.
If you're a time traveler, does it really matter whether time passed on the outside or not?
Well,
for the time traveler, no. For the nerds watching the show, yes.
Well, 2 billion years, our sun has exploded.
True.
I had a couple of, there were a few astrophysicists that were chiming in on this saying, well, yes, the movement of the stars and everything looking out of whack, there'd also be a lot fewer stars that he recognized in the sky because they're all dead and burned out at this point and so forth. So it must have been something where within the relative construct of,
well,
of
the dial. He would recognize stars from different times as well. Mm. He was just expecting to see a certain thing in the sky for the time period he's in, and he was seeing the stars for a different time period.
Right, right. So then that leaves me with the one question, if it was a different passage of time outside the dial, if his teleport bracelet actually just put him within the dial, by the time he comes out of it, he's, well, on that very recognizable landscape, then there was obviously the process of getting that dial there by someone's hand. We're assuming it's probably a shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And that also means that someone got it there through the time lock.
No, because Gallifrey is just back now.
Back, but still lost. So someone knew.
Missy?
She says she knew. She never actually divulged the information. I don't know if that was just a ruse.
But she's the only person I could think of that would even have an idea of how to look.
Yeah, unless the Time Lords were just biding their time and they were already back in the universe and they're like, we're just going to sit over here quietly until it's our time to go and really jack up with the Doctor's life and, you know, bite ourselves in the ass because we killed off his companion. Oops.
Well, and it's interesting. There may be a couple of other groups out there who have the kind of breadth of knowledge of being able to locate Gallifrey, like the Sisters of Karn. Their sort of transcendent knowledge could be something that gives them that insight. That's the sort of the magic meets the science sort of side of things. Which, and I believe, not to kind of jump too far ahead, but I believe we saw some of the promo photos that they will be featured in Hellbent in the finale. So they're in the mix. Okay, well that kind of brings us to the final moment. The jump off your couch. Fist pump. We were hoping we were going to get this back during the break before this series started. Mm-hmm. Like, damn it, they didn't deal with it in series 8. They dragged me all the way through it. He seems to have forgotten about it. When is this going to come back to the table? Now. Now it's back.
Yes. So we've got Gallifrey back. We've got the return of the Time Lords and the military council looks like it's going to make a return from the next time trailer. So, it looks like, all right, some of the production screens we've got looks like the High Council is going to be there. We've got the Military Council is going to be there, or at least, representatives from it. So, it looks like they're hitting a lot of the high points here, and I'm really wondering, I don't think this is going to be a conclusion to a series. I'm thinking the next episode is going to set up series 10.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's far too much now on the table, I think, for them to resolve it, even in what is supposed to be touted as a longer finale, you know, by X number of minutes. It doesn't give them nearly the opportunity to be able to pull all of the pieces together so that Moffat can, in his very, you know, Moffat-y way, say, look how clever I've been for all the breadcrumbs I've been giving you for probably, he's going to tap back to stuff in Series 8. Oh, and yeah. Say, look, I was giving it to you then.
I wouldn't be surprised if he taps back into stuff from like Series 5 and 6, because that's how Moffat do.
Mm, yeah. Well, there are also some rumors and suppositions about some faces or identities that will emerge within the finale, based on some production photos that the BBC put out right after this episode aired. But I don't even want to put that in the news links. You can seek that out if you choose to.
Yeah.
But to help me out, back me up to, because I was going to, I just did not have the time because I kept rewatching this episode. I was going to go back and watch Day of the Doctor again, just to see how everything, what was a very kind of one-sided conversation, how terms were left with the Time Lords and the communication through the crack when he got his reset or his, we don't really
exactly. Undetermined extra number of regeneration.
Right. Could have been a reprieve, could have been a reset. But as far as, it looked like it was another one of those instances where you did us a solid, Doctor. We'll come around and call for you again the next time we need something.
Honestly, it seemed more like it was, because I remember it was Clara who was, you know, sitting there screaming at the crack and telling them that, you know, they owed him something or another. And to me, it seemed more like, you know, they're sitting there at the hole listening like, oh, wait, things got bad. Yeah, let's go ahead and give him the tool he needs to fix this so that we don't have to get involved again.
Mm.
So,
but it doesn't seem like something where whatever has transpired between then and now that he is under scrutiny for some transgressions. Or maybe that's just it. Maybe wherever they've been, they're still observing,
mm-hmm.
and something that he's been doing has been, yet again, another violation of the laws of time. We've got to deal with him.
We told you not to have a party while we were gone, and look what you did.
You started wearing sunglasses. We told you never to start playing the guitar again, because it's painful.
Quit playing that damn rock and roll.
But if it's a matter of, or is it something where, because now he's starting to be, he's been tipped off that there are people seeking the truth about the hybrid again.
Mm-hmm.
Gallifrey's been lost. It's out there somewhere. And oh, what a coincidence. There are a bunch of rogues and mercenaries and everybody else out gunning because they need information on this hybrid.
Honestly, it seems more like, to me, what it seems like is that in the time of the Doctor, they were trying to come back. They were trying to come back through the crack and said, oh, look what us calling for the Doctor did. It brought all these people out. And hey, look, the Daleks are still here. Crap, we need a way to deal with them so that we don't get another time war. Hey, there was supposed to be that hybrid thing. Why don't we search for that and see if we can destroy him that way? You know, that's what I think this is going to wind up being, is that, you know, it's a bunch of the Time Lords or a section of Time Lords or whatever who are trying to find it either as a means of defeating the Daleks or in fear that that might be what the Daleks use against them.
Right. We need the ultimate weapon before that same weapon falls into the hand. Okay.
Right.
Well, then that brings you to your final reveal. Mm. So take it verbatim here. Kid runs off. So he's just standing there looking at the dial, which we know has been gathering all the information to convey over to the Time Lords. That's what the dial is intended for, to get them to bear all their sins. And he says, you can probably still hear me, so just between ourselves, you've got the prophecy wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The hybrid is not half Dalek. Nothing is half Dalek, which right. I love. Nothing is half Dalek. The Daleks would never allow that. The hybrid destined to conquer Gallifrey and stand in its ruins is me.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Well, yep. there's a couple different school of thoughts. Mm-hmm. The
Paul McGann vindicated.
That's honestly human. That is getting a lot more credibility than I honestly believed at first, and that was the first thing that popped into my head too. Was oh wow, they're gonna like make the 96 movie canonical, and he actually is half human. But then you have to think, okay, if you know the way that he says it, you know, that the hybrid is me, well, what has Ashildur been calling herself ever since she came back? It was
lowercase m, uppercase m.
Right.
Me or meek.
But the problem I have with that is every time he has run into her, he has called her Ashildur. He doesn't call her me. So, I don't know.
Maybe he's screwing with the Time Lords by saying it that way.
Maybe. Or maybe it's just Moffat out-clevering himself. Or
yeah, also. It's
clever dialogue. I'd hate for it to be something where they try to introduce, especially with how solid everything's been running lately, to introduce something to muddy up the mix. Oh, well, I am a hybrid. I'm half Time Lord and half, you know, the Booble Flats from the planet Zarquang, and bring in something that is completely nonsensical for the sake of saying, well, we had y'all worked up over nothing.
There's the line from the Next Time trailer that, you know, the hybrid is a mix between two great warrior races. So, you know, first thought obviously is, oh, well, it's going to be, you know, a Zygarin, you know, a Zygon / Sontaran or something, you know, but then you think about it, I'm like, okay, well, no, technically the Time Lords could very well be called a warrior race. And
oh yeah, by all means.
And what happens when we see all of the, you know, the church show up in later episodes and things like that? That's who makes up the bulk of that army? Humans. Mm-hmm. What's the vast majority of the human history? You know, it's us figuring out new and inventive ways of killing each other. So
and colonizing in the process. Scattering ourselves all over. Little bugs.
We're an infestation. Like
dandelion seeds.
Starting to understand Agent Smith from the Matrix a little bit more now.
Yeah. So I guess it's a matter of you can kind of play around with what are the possible repercussions of allowing, you know, the half-human doctor idea to float. You know, is it really that detrimental of an aspect to incorporate into canon? I mean, there are already enough people that hate Moffat for some of the things that he has added to the program. But
how dare you give us the best episodes we've ever seen?
technically, this was not him. But it's again, we go back to our conversations where you have to start incorporating some elements of change in order to breathe new life into a show that is built on that idea. So, you know, gain new audience, find something new to play with so you're not just writing the same handful of stories over and over and over. So I guess it's a matter of what some of the dangers are of saying that this character that we have perceived to be, with the 1996 exception, to be, you know, the Gallifreyan. We had glimpses of his parents in the shack when we had, you know, the doctor is a boy moments. There was nothing odd there necessarily about his parents. There's his behavior that was called into question.
There was nothing saying that those actually were his parents. They could have been random people he was living with. We found this baby on the doorstep. What do we do with it? Let's raise it as our own.
It's Uncle Ben.
Put him out to work in the cheaper than adoption. Yes, we got a guy in a buffalo reference in. It has taken us all year to get a guy in a buffalo reference into this.
Ding, ding, ding. I was actually just watching that like last week. It's hilarious.
Those of you who have no idea what we're talking about, go find out what we're talking about. Thank us later. Okay, so. All right. Well, I'm willing to roll with it because right now, I mean, we've been handed such a phenomenal episode. Now that we've kind of talked about the mechanics, let's just talk about how damn good this episode was. I mean, Capaldi ran the gauntlet of emotional conveyance in this thing. You know, from wonder to logic to reason to anger to humor to his breakdown. I was just in awe of the work he put into this.
For me, the most amazing parts were where he wanted to quit. He just was ready to give up. And he started to do it the first time he went into the TARDIS. And, you know, he pulled himself back together. And then again when he went in later. And he was just right on the edge of giving up on all of it. It was amazing to watch.
Yeah. Were you both okay with using the Clara, memory of Clara catalyst to get him through?
I would have been more okay if he had just looked up and saw the writing on the chalkboard. I didn't like seeing the back of Clara. I liked it less when we saw all of Clara because it's like, she's gone. Let her be gone.
Yeah, that was the point. My only point of contention with this episode is that he's, once again, when it came to his cornerstone characters, he always pulls his punches. And, you know, we get Amy one more time in a memory or in a vision. We get Clara one more time in an internal monologue manifestation.
We just, get Eleven calling back in.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to be the oddball here. I liked it. I thought that it was great, especially since the first few times that you see her, you see, like, the back of her, and it almost looks like a mannequin. You know, like, it didn't look like Jenna Coleman standing there. So I was like, okay.
You like that Moffat kissed the boo-boo for you?
No, I like the fact that it was like he's got this, you know, this stand-in. Like, okay, Clara's not here, but I've got, like, you know, I've got Head Simmons over here in case I need her. You know, it's it was nice having that. Okay, he's still relying on her. He's still dealing with the loss of what he's gone through, and it helped me because it seemed real to me because this was way too soon for him to already be moving on and being like, I've got to figure this out on my own. You know, it made the loss real. For the doctor. And then what?
Yeah, well, I think, but that could have been just as effectively done since we were getting his arguments within his own head,
mm-hmm.
that he could have done things like that saying, oh, I know what you're going to say. You would tell me, blah, 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 blah. Or as Haley said, just continue to go with the chalkboard.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the thing is because it was just the chalkboard and because it was just, you know, the almost mannequin looking thing or whatever it seemed like that's what was going. And then you have the moment where he is just about to give up. He is just about ready to just, you know, give up and die. And then you see her hand on his face and then the camera pans and you actually see her. And I thought it was beautifully done. And it was I was all ready to hate on her coming back into the show because I knew she was going to, because let's face it, Moffat. But the way that they went about it, the way that it was done, I was like, no, this was great. It's in his head. It's not, you know, it's not a hallucination while he's standing there next to Clara. This is all happening in his head, so it makes sense. You know, it's not even a thing of, oh, well, she was just a projection from the confession dial. This is his headspace, and of course she would be there. So it fit for me, and I liked it.
I see your point. I just don't know if the show warranted it.
I'm not saying that it couldn't have been done to great or possibly even better effect had they not had her there. But this didn't bother me. I appreciated it, and I'm okay with it. I'm not saying that it was the best way to go about it, but it didn't bother me.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's not sticking with me. It's not something that in any way I feel is detracting from my appreciation of the episode, because, you know, Capaldi's performance under Talley's direction, the editing, especially when you start getting into the more rapid iterations, it was very erratic. It wasn't like one of these instances where you've seen, because, you know, people have played with the whole the looping time, do this over and over bit, and when it's edited, you just keep seeing the same segments 10 seconds long, then 6 seconds long, then 2 seconds long. It just blurs. This had little lengths, little stops and starts, where you'd get little moments that dragged longer than others, or you'd see them in a different room again that you didn't on the last loop.
Yeah.
So from an editing perspective, I really loved it too, and the score was incredible.
Oh yeah, I mean, honestly, there were 5 stars of this episode for me. Obviously, Capaldi. Capaldi needs to get all the awards. You know, the BAFTAs, the Emmys, the Tonys, the, you know, Consumer Reports Best in Safety for Midsize Sedan. Just give him everything. And then, obviously, Moffat was on point with the script. And Talalay, absolutely brilliant as a director. I'm absolutely in love with her directing Doctor Who. It's fantastic. But, like you said, Murray Gold did a fantastic job with this episode because, let's face it, we had to have a lot more music because there wasn't a lot of dialogue to fill up the space. So you had music practically throughout, and it was such a great mix and such a fantastic, you know, sound to it all that it was, you know, fantastical without being too, you know, Harry Potter. And it was all interesting stuff that didn't really, you don't expect to hear in Doctor Who. But it fit beautifully. So, I mean, I've got to say, Murray Gold was on point with that one. And then for William Oswald doing the film editing, I mean, just like you were saying, the montage, where instead of, here, let's take this, you know, 8 minutes of film and start cutting it down more and more and more until, you know, everyone's ready to vomit their eyeballs out because it's just so boring. No, I mean, they took different shots of the same scene and started putting it in there. And it as it was going on, I'm like, this should be getting old by now, but it's not. It's interesting. And I want to actually go through and start, like, you know, almost freeze framing it just to see if there's anything I missed.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's very, very carefully constructed, very carefully shot. You know, all the scene alignments as far as camera angles, as far as use of shadow, of moments where, you know, the dead end trails that you're being given in some of the early scenes on the first pass through. So we're looking for clues that aren't there, mm-hmm. but they look interesting because just the entire scenario of what's in the frame is interesting, and your eyes just want to take it all in. It's just a very, very well constructed and thought through production.
Yeah. And you can absolutely see Rachel Talalay's, you know, influence from the horror genre. You can see where she where she got started on it. With all of this, but it's not done in such a way of like, hey, this is a horror movie. It was, you can tell she's a seasoned director and she knows what she is doing. She knows when to use certain aspects and when to back off.
Mm. Yeah. Some people were saying, you know, why is she still writing for Doctor Who? She should be back doing major motion pictures at this point. She's as much as we love having her here, she's wasting her time doing television right now. And then someone else sent her, they did a fan sketch of Jenna Coleman in the Tank Girl uniform.
Oh, nice.
With the helmet and everything. It's Tank Girl 2. And she went nuts. She's like, this is what I want to do. This 1,000 times. This. That would be funny.
I'd be okay with that movie. I want to see that.
So, well, we've got plenty of things to chew on for Hellbent, which we're going from a cast of 1.2 to a cast of 102. This is going to be huge. And if you are of the type that did not want to watch the scenes for the next time, do not want to know about anything that's coming in on the finale, totally fine. Absolutely respect that. I do it with some other shows. This is not one of them because as long as I don't have plot elements thrown at me, if you're going to tell me, oh, this character comes back, well, I might be okay with that.
Well, we did have just a couple listeners chime in on this. Imagine that. Huh. Fantastic episode.
Oh, yeah. If we left you out, just because we got deluged on this one through the various social channels. So if you got left out, don't worry. I've been trying to respond to folks on a personal level through our accounts. But yeah, we had to cull this down a little bit.
So Ben wrote to us on Facebook and said, Heaven Sent and Day of the Doctor are the gold standard of modern Who, and I honestly feel it will be a long time before they are topped. I can agree with that, but I'm not ready to say that it'll be a long time before they get topped because we haven't watched Hellbent yet.
Yep, that's true. That's true. And as long as Moffat and Minchin and directors like Talalay and so forth are continuing to, or writers like Jamie Mathis and so forth are still writing for a Doctor who is putting this kind of expansion into the character, or taking some of these chances and doing some very, very different things, we still have room to go.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and then let's see. Then Preston wrote to us on Twitter and had 4 points. One, Capaldi is the Doctor. He ain't acting. Yeah, I agree with that. Two, he is the hybrid and ran to save Gallifrey from himself. So he's of the camp that the Doctor's at least some form of hybrid. Mm-hmm. Three, the Time Lords just killed Clara to draw him home. And four, they totally screwed up.
All right, killing Clara to draw him home. Well, she...
Yeah, I don't think that was part of the plan, but I don't think the Doctor's going to split hairs in that aspect.
Nope. Yeah, that's involuntary manslaughter.
And then Kodiak wrote to us on Twitter as well and said, frankly, after last night, I'm going to have to reevaluate who my Doctor is.
Yeah,
I completely feel you there.
Kodiak, as I do, that's a big statement.
I mean, I had that come to Jesus moment after the Zygon inversion, and this just cemented my decision. I'm like, yeah, no, this is Capaldi is absolutely my Doctor. Mm-hmm. Absolutely brilliant.
We had another tweet come in from Jonathan, who's written us a few times, said, tonight's episode was excellent in so many ways. I haven't really been able to find anything to complain about yet. And our conversation went on to kind of discuss the fact that other people, for some reason, weren't getting it. There are actually a couple people that were saying some things about it, saying that they found it particularly... I remember reading one that said, this was the most boring thing I think I've been handed, and I'm now tapping out of the show after being a fan of it for whatever insert number of decades. And I just thought to myself, really? This now? This is where you decide to tap out?
Wow.
After everything you've gone through, an episode like this is the one thing that makes you push back from the table and go, nah.
I mean, I can understand
they
being like...
They love the Sandman, but this.
I can understand watching this and being like, you know what? I'm going out on the high point because it's never going to get this good again. Like, that statement I can get behind.
Mm. Well, speaking about some kind of dissent or just some things that left some people still trying to work them through, like we had some feedback that did that. Our friend Will, discussing it, said, you know, he looked at the confession dial and he said it's kind of like the Maltese Falcon. If you want to use sort of Hollywood terms, it's a MacGuffin. It's nothing more than a device that moves the story forward. Ah, okay. I think it might have a little bit, personally, in my response, I think it might have a little more depth to it than just being that vehicle, because it serves a number of purposes mm-hmm. within the story, not just a propulsion element, but splitting hairs. And he said, you know, he kind of believes that because that's why it's never been heard about over 52 years of the show, and the rules surrounding it are a bit vague. I completely understand that. It has been recently introduced because, again, it's Moffat mm-hmm. dropping some new aspects in to kind of, you know, increase the complexity level. But yeah, keeping the rules about it a little vague, I think it's because if you spent too long really taking it apart, you'd blow the whole episode dealing with the logistics of confession dials.
That Moffat likes to do that. He likes to leave himself a little wiggle room until he's really got it figured out.
Mm. Yep. And then we also had, and this is a really good point. I'm really glad that Soleil brought this up. He said, you know, he likes the touch that the doctor finds his outfit dry and warm after getting out of the water. It kind of solves the Marty McFly Back to the Future 2 thing about getting wet. Doesn't fix the fact that his hair was really dry by the time he was done changing, but maybe he's very meticulous about changing his clothes. Maybe it took him a lot.
I mean, just look at
it's
how
a very
he, you
know, toasty fire.
He put the coat back that way, and he took the time to set the boot back up. So, yeah, he took his time.
Yeah. But he was catching some of the technical aspects of it, like, you know, well, if every room resets, why are his clothes there? Well, because they were there on the first reset, so they're always going to be there in every reset, if you accept that. Remember, this whole castle was built to be something for him. This is his interrogation castle, mm-hmm. Hogwarts. And he struggles with the punching the Asbantium wall because, you know, and he was wondering, shouldn't that reset too? But if you guys are right on the fact that the core, the center of this rotating castle does not change. Everything else around it resets, but it spins around that mm-hmm. That central point. Yeah, I can take that too.
Yeah, so and let's not overlook the serious thing that if the wall reset, then we really wouldn't have much of an episode to watch.
Not if he used the shovel. It was right there.
Mm-hmm. But then we wouldn't get to watch his amazing face of, ow, that hurt.
God, that really, I got to do it again. Ow, no, it still hurts. Just as bad as the first time. Well, third time's going to be better. No, that's probably worse because now my hand's already sore.
He's the kind of guy that like listens to the waitress say, careful with the plate, it's really hot, and then immediately wants to check how hot it is. It's like, oh man, you weren't lying. Dang. Maybe it's cooled off now. Oh, no.
Her tolerance for pain is probably different than mine.
I've never been guilty of that, no.
Caution, contents hot. Well, we are going to go screeching into Hellbent on our finale. This should be interesting. We've got... as I said, if you want to find out some details, because there are some things that BBC has already divulged that is open knowledge, it's not really necessarily leaked information or anything of that sort, but it is still technically spoilers, so
yeah, I would
choose it out.
I would definitely be very careful, because the official synopsis of Heavensent that they released, the BBC released before the episode ever went out, included, and the Doctor finds Gallifrey at the end of the description. It's like, I mean, they spoiled
thanks,
the
guys.
Ending. Like, so apparently somebody at the BBC isn't, you know, really sure what the policy is on spoilers there. So yeah, tread carefully. We're not even safe from the Beebs anymore.
Gets back to Gallifrey, finds his childhood home where he first learned he was the hybrid, finds his toy sled, Rosebud. Rosebud is a sled.
Spoilers, I haven't seen that yet.
Ah, you're never going to watch it.
No, I'm not.
I like how she
isn't
just
that one of those films like Before the World Had Color? God, I don't even... It was bad enough trying to watch Hartnell in black and white.
She still hadn't made it through that.
I know, she's plodding through that right now.
By plodding, you mean not making any forward motion at all. Yes, that's what I'm doing.
It's a quagmire. It's a veritable quagmire.
All right, we ready to get into the news?
Sure.
Yes, we are.
All right. So the first bit of news that we're going to talk about here is this is very interesting how Moffat has been talking a lot more lately. Like he's figured out, oh, wait, I can actually say things that make sense and people are going to love it. There's an interview with Stephen Moffat and Peter Capaldi talking about Heaven Sent. And this actually came out prior to the episode airing, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I believe 2 days, or at least when I first came across it. Mm-hmm. But this is one of those kind of sit down conversations that I'll bet even the interviewer was not expecting to get as much shared with them as they did. Because they've got, there's details in here about the production cycle. There's details about what it's like writing for a single voice for, you know, close to 50 minutes and the complexity levels involved in that. And we were talking last week about the fact that Moffat was discussing his writing process for the Day of the Doctor. It's like, oh, I barely got that thing in the can in time. I was still writing pages. I was running to the studio kind of thing. So he's really kind of letting the curtain back so we can see how this stuff has happened. But they discuss the nature of cliffhangers, the loss of companions, all of these things getting divulged before we even were handed this single-handed episode. Yeah. So an interesting read altogether, not just because of the information, but also just seeing how much they're willing, Moffat in particular, is willing to discuss about the mechanics of running this show.
Yeah, it's a very interesting article, and seeing some of the things that you know get discussed. One of the things that the interviewer asked was, you know, Jenna said that she might want to come back to the show at some point, but you've been reported as saying she couldn't because of the way the storyline plays out. What's your line on that? Could she make a comeback? And, you know, Moffat, obviously being Moffat, said, I think I said something which was translated from Italian and then back into English. I didn't quite say that. And then says, you know, obviously you can never say that no one will ever come back to Doctor Who because it's, you know, the nature of the show or whatever. But goes on to say it's possible that she might return, but doesn't give a lot of hope for that. And then they said, speaking of things coming back, is there a way that Gallifrey could return? And Moffat just simply says, yes, because it's out there. So you could definitely see the planet Gallifrey return. Mm. And that is all he says on it.
Yeah, and that's fine. I do really appreciate the article, too, for a lot of the stuff that Capaldi gets to divulge, you know, and we know, you know, how much this is the fulfillment of a lifelong dream to play this character. And it's something that I think he is literally like bouncing excited to go to work every day when he does this, because this is a manifestation of this dream. But he was talking about, they were talking about his disposition and the fact that he's kind of softened through 9 because his relationship with Clara deepened and so forth. But he's like, he brought up this great thing. There's this sort of this inverse chart about his softness as he starts to become less spiky and yet more crap ends up falling on him. So he said, I should have just been cynical and suspicious the entire time, and everything would have worked out fine. There's a reason why I'm paranoid like this, because it saves lives.
Nice. All right. What's the next article that we've got here?
Let's see. To sort of take these in some interesting order. There was a. Did you get a chance to read over the article about this letter that was found inside a Beatles book?
A little bit. I didn't actually get the chance to read the letter though.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I guess, so this bookseller had you know, all these used books. You see them, when I was in the UK, there was all these like little stands where people were just reselling all these paperbacks. I grabbed a bunch of classic Who books last time I was there. But someone just, you know, picked up a $5 book, and inside was this little letter, because it was a photographic history of the Beatles. And the letter's there. You can actually see it scanned, if you want to take a look at it, from this individual, Brett Stewart. And it's like a Dear Santa letter, but it was written by this girl. I'm not sure if they ever determined the actual age of the girl, if it's actually divulged in here. But it starts out as like, my dearest doctor, how strange it seems to write to you, like a child writing to Santa. You're fictional, after all, non-existent, made up, invented, pure pretend, and yet you've impacted my life more heavily than anyone living has ever changed me, doctor. And it goes on and on like this. This is a gorgeous, gorgeous letter. And it means there's no rhyme or reason for it. It's almost like fan fiction, I guess, in a way. But it's, you know, it ends with things like, you know, you showed me that though, I don't think you showed me, I don't think you know about it. Life is about living, feeling your blood rush and pump and feeling your heart swell with emotion. And that's what I do every day without fail. I live and I am ecstatically, beautifully happy. Thank you for that. And it's just this girl, Ariel, whoever she is, however old she was at the time, handwriting kind of tells me she was maybe teens, 20s. I don't know. This isn't schoolgirl writing.
Right.
But it's, this is someone who gets it. Mm-hmm. They have internalized the show. They've gotten the core message out of it, the underlying theme, and she gets it. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I've been sitting here looking at it while you were reading it, and I mean, this is, it's a brilliant summation of what it means to be a Whovian, because I think everyone that has ever been touched by this show could look at this and find at least one phrase that says, yeah, that's exactly it. That is exactly what it means. So definitely
New worth hashtag. I am Ariel.
Definitely worth going and checking it out. It's fantastic, but
yeah.
And then looking a little bit forward to the future here, there's some, a little bit of a question has come up as to whether or not, we've talked about the rumor before, but it's come back into the forefront that could Peter Jackson possibly be directing an episode of Doctor Who? Now,
okay.
Now that this came about because of a little video that Peter Jackson actually posted on his Facebook, where he's sitting there with what appears to be, I guess, his daughter or something, and
yeah,
polishing his Oscars, you know, as you're wont to do when you have multiples. And just, you know, talking about, oh, Stephen Moffat sent you another email again. Well, I never understand what that guy's saying anyway. And you know, the topic of him directing Doctor Who comes up again. And then some strange man in a suit walks into his room and hands him what appears to be a contract.
But he's busy kind of wandering around looking at things suspiciously and then gets chased out of the room by a Dalek. While Jackson and his daughter continue to discuss the complexities of the contract and what the obligations would mean going from a 6 month production cycle to something that has to be done in 10 days for an episode rollout. It's all right. So saw this yesterday evening. The interwebs exploded over this today. Even so far as what I thought to be reputable news reporting organizations calling this confirmation that Jackson, no. Not even close, because if this were just being some sort of tongue-in-cheek way of saying, yeah, all right, I was busy, but I'm going to make the time for it because it's important to me and it's clearly important to you too. The discussion between Jackson and his daughter was completely improvised. They were stumbling over words, searching for something to say. This was by no means really that carefully prepared.
No.
So I think it would have had a little bit more polish to it. But it's just for fun. Just
because
I guess they're under the belief that if they repeat it often enough, it will become true. Click your heels 3 times.
Well, I mean, it still gives you a little bit of something.
No, it's the secret, dude. You know, you put the thought out there in the universe.
Right.
I guess. I yeah.
I will be interested to see where this goes. Because up till now, it's just been a lot of fans saying, that would be amazing. We should totally vie for that. And Moffat and Jackson both being like, no, that sounds like a good idea. It never actually worked, but that sounds cool. And that was it. And here we have much more solid something to go on. Whether it's just for fun or not, it's definitely added a lot of fuel to the fire. So
yeah. And it'll keep the rumor mill grinding for a while, and that's fine too. But it just shows, at least at this point, because Jackson has said in interviews in the past that that if all time permitting and all schedules allowing things, he would love to be able to do it. It's not anything he's ever said he's averse to. Mm-hmm. So now at this point, I think it's just a matter of a little buzz to the fans, a little poke in the ribs.
Just
wouldn't it be nice?
Hand him Gatiss's next script, and we can see if we can at least make it tolerable.
Oh, because then it'll just be Gatiss's script with 3 hours of running across fields.
That would definitely improve it. It's like, oh, thank God, we've got 45 minutes of running across the field before we get back into that.
Giant booger men running across fields in New Zealand.
Oh, but then...
All right. These other items here, I'm not really sure how much of them we really want to put in. Even the image. I'm even going to say that the image, even though I know that's been a sanctioned release... All right. Well, maybe.
Okay. Well, no, it's okay. Let's talk about the image. We'll just talk about the one thing that I highlighted in this. It has been, you know, they've said it before that the Sonic shades are a temporary thing, and we have not seen them go away yet. And everybody is just, you know, waiting with bated breath to see what happens. Well, this image from the Christmas special shows Mr. Capaldi holding what appears to be a new Sonic device.
All right, have you like looked at like the zoomed in photos to see if they can make out what kind of, you know, mark variation this is?
I have not yet. It's what I'm actually doing at this very moment. It's what I'm doing right now. Hang on.
Fair.
No, it's
because I mean, is there something in River's hand as well, or is that just a pizza cutter?
It looks like a pokey thing.
She's got a knife. Pokey. I don't know. But I don't know. But
I want to know if that's Matt Lucas in the robot suit, because it was announced that Matt Lucas from Little Britain. For those of you who may be familiar with the British sketch comedy, we've had David Williams on the show before as a number of characters, but I believe this may be Matt Lucas's first foray into it. So it'd be great to have him on. He's a phenomenal voice actor. He's comedic. Genius. His timing is fantastic, and but I don't. I looked really quickly at the character name that they associated with him, and obviously not knowing anything about the script and don't know how that fits into it. But we've had comedians in robot suits before, in Christmas episodes actually. So yeah, it seems to go around again. But yeah, the screwdriver. I think we're just going to see a slight shift on the previous model. They're just,
no,
this is like a 9 to 10 transition.
Nope. This actually looks remarkably different now that I'm looking at a
high res.
It's, I mean, the, okay. Do I really need to go into like detail about it or
no?
it is different. It is not Matt Smith's screwdriver. There is a marked difference. It's not going to be a rebranding of the same screwdriver.
Okay.
So, yep. Get out your wallets, nerds.
Yay!
Yep. Yet another new universal toys. Remote I got to purchase from Rubber Toe Replicas.
Just something else to freak out the cats with.
But if if the image doesn't give you enough to squee over, there is an article out there that starts to talk about a lot more in detail how River is going to be involved in the Christmas special. Now this
spoilers.
Is a,
yeah,
I don't even want to read this article.
Yeah, I have not
I
clicked
it.
On the article.
I did because it's about River.
Go figure. No, so we will include it in the show notes with a big old spoiler tag on it. So if you want to look, if you want to read it, it is there for you to to pick up and check out. But yeah, we're not going to go into details with that.
Yeah, but big buyer beware on that one.
But the last bit of news that we've got here is more just a clarification of something. Now, did anyone else notice this while we were watching the episode?
Yeah, on first pass.
Yeah.
And it was bugging me because I wanted to keep watching, but I kind of wanted to back up and see what that was because I never put it in the shot again.
Exactly. So there was in one scene when the doctor first recognizes the veil across the way, staring at him from the throughout the window and figures out what the TV screens are doing. On the wall next to him, there's a projection of, you know, some kind of poem or words or something like that. And it's always kept like slightly, you know, it's off to the side, kind of out of focus. Like it never pays attention to what it actually says. And so it was bothering me the whole time. It bothered me for like 30 seconds until more shiny things happened and I was just wrapped up in the story again. But it is actually part of what the doctor says at the beginning of the episode. You know, that as you come into this world, something else is also born. You begin your life and it begins a journey. Towards you, wherever you go, whatever path you take, it will follow. You will notice a second shadow next to yours. Your life will then be over.
And so it walks through a segment of his opening monologue. Mm-hmm. By the way, if you haven't gotten into the habit of doing this sort of thing and seeking out the transcripts for these episodes after they release, either by, you know, a lot of times if you purchase them on iTunes, you get the closed captioning file that comes along with it, which you can just read through. But this is yet another episode this season where just off the page, it's a fascinating read, mm-hmm. even outside of the episode. And it's monologues like that, or you know, as Haley was saying, the whole segment where he's breaking down, why can't I just lose just for once? Why do I always have to be the one to win? You know, and that exhaustion, mm-hmm. as he's really breaking down, is just amazing right off, you know, right in print.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's, I mean, and the fact that they put that in there and it wasn't, you never drew attention to it, it was just there. And you realize at the beginning of the episode that the Doctor is literally reading the writing on the wall. But they had to keep it as a, you know, out of focus thing. Otherwise, we'd have known exactly what was going on from the get-go. But it's another thing that's like, hey, look, we put stuff in there. And if you're sharp enough to pick it up, then you know what's going on before anybody else. But the vast majority of the time, you don't pick up on it because, hey, look, this story is amazing and you're distracted. So
keep going. I mean, punch.
It's just like you said, you know, it's like you wanted to go back and find out what it was, but you couldn't stop yourself from watching.
Yep. So very true. So, going back to that comment, our feedback about the gold standard. Yeah. If this is where we're at right now, you know, it may get surpassed, but right now we are riding an absolute high as far as the qualities are these episodes, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, definitely. So, all right. Well, this has been episode 164 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I finally run out of corridor. There's a life summed up.
This is Kier saying, these tacos taste funny to you.
And this is Haley saying, my day can't get any worse. Let's see what we can do about yours.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio or on Facebook at facebook.com/Gallifrey Public Radio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2015.
So Haley, how was Black Friday in the Hellmouth?
Flawless execution, according to our regional manager. I don't know, like two levels above store manager. Okay. She was hanging out in our store, babysitting us, and she was like, "Yeah, you guys did awesome. Zero accidents.
Wow, no stabbings at
no
all.
No casualties.
Okay, zero. Funny you should mention that. Zero accidents
But you had one death
on Thursday and Black Friday. But yes, an associate died like 2 days ago in the store.
What?
So the aneurysm formed on Black Friday.
Yep.
He dropped in the aisle?
In the bathroom. In the bathroom in the break room, actually. So the break room shut down all morning. Yeah, we still don't know what it was.
Man.
But apparently he had been talked to because he had 3 points. And if he gets another point, he gets coached. So he wouldn't go home. The guy literally died to avoid getting another point.
Wow.
That's the place I work.
there's a point where dedication to your job does not seem admirable anymore. Oh, man.
I'm just concerned about dying in the bathroom. I don't want to poop myself to death.
I think he puked himself to death, but we don't know actually why he died.
Equally bad.
Well, I mean, you know, bodily functions happen when you die. So if you're going to go, at least be in the bathroom, be considerate for the people that have to clean up after you. It's like, oh man, he died and crapped himself, but hey, at least it's there.
You know what the absolute worst part of that day was? We were out of the
It wasn't the dead
donuts.
Body.
God damn.
Okay. Then we got our priorities right in line.
Terrible.
You can just see as they're rolling the body bag away on the gurney, and there's Haley looking into the break room, just throws her hands up. God damn it.
They don't give us free donuts. You have to go and buy them from the bakery. And I wanted to say, this is the worst day ever. We're out of my fucking donut. But I thought that might be insensitive.
Could this day get any worse?
No one could possibly be having a worse day than me right now.
Oh, dear God. We're all going to hell. Haley's driving the bus, though. Oh, man. So...
Come on! It's like somebody's got it out for me! Who was it? Who bought the last one? It was probably that dead guy!
Well, he got what was coming to him.
God damn it!
Oh my god.
Yeah, officer, I told him if I ever saw him buying the last donut when he knew I was waiting for one, I'd kill him!
I'd make him choke on it.
I told him he'd live to regret it!
Guess the joke's on me, huh?
Oh, oddly enough, the next day there were plenty of double chocolate donuts left.
Triple chocolate.
Triple chocolate.
She doesn't resort to homicide for double chocolate.
I just rough you up a bit for double chocolate.
Oh, man. So you got any stories that can top that one, Kier?
Not even close. I don't think I know anyone who has pooped him into an early grave or wished anyone's demise over pastries. No, I got nothing to top that one.
Yeah. Sorry.
Thankfully.
Apparently,
I'm kind of okay with that.
Apparently, Frederick has died of dysentery.
He's never going to make it out in the wagon trail.
And Haley has no idea what we're talking about.
I played the shit out of Oregon Trail.
Yeah.
Who the f*** do you think you're talking to?
Oh, man. We got Haley all fired up now.
Yeah, now she's just going to stare at the ceiling all night and wonder, have I just doomed myself? Making jokes about donuts and death? Donuts and death. Donuts and death! New tagline for GPR. It's going to be on the back of the t-shirts. Donuts and death.
Or should it be donuts or death?
Why death choose? By chocolate. Death by chocolate, literally.
This is the perfect case for the Badger gif. Why can't we have both?
Man. All right, we should probably go ahead and wrap up before we...
Yeah, all I'm smelling is brake pads burning. We're just skidding downhill in this one.
All right. We'll see you guys later.
Out.
Night.